Welcome to episode 13 of season 2 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Monday, the 14th of September 2009, and in this episode, we're going to get our teeth into open source dentistry. We'll cover the latest news and events. We've got news about OgCamp, followed by another command line lerv, with a difference this time. Then we'll look at the ecosphere and also feedback. I'm Simon, and with me this week are Laura.
Hello.
Hiya.
Hiya.
Got to use your catchphrase.
That went down well, I think.
What have you been up to, Laura? Anything spectacular over the last couple of weeks?
We had the Hampshire Linux user group at IBM Hersley on Saturday for, it was kind of a bring a box meet, but it turned out as more of talks and things, and I gave a talk.
It was good.
Oh, what about? I wasn't there.
Were you?
I wasn't there. That's why I'm, that's why I'm asking the question, because you were, and that's obvious. In fact, all three of you were.
I was there, yeah.
So I thought it'd be good if I asked.
I fell asleep during it, so I could ask what it was about.
Ah, okay.
I didn't really. It was very good.
Yeah.
What was it about?
It was about InfoSlicer, an open source project I worked on last summer with some students.
What does it do?
It's a piece of educational software for teachers to help them download content from the web and then edit it offline.
Oh, cool.
It's like a smart wiki.
You mentioned this a little while ago when we talked about taking pictures of Firefox, I think.
And you talked about, it's the Sugar desktop, isn't it?
Yeah, that goes on the OLPC laptops and other things.
And that's what caused Dave to have such hysterics during
Epiplexy.
The last record. Yeah.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah, Dave's not here this week, we should add.
Oh yeah, we didn't mention that, did we? Oops.
What about you, Tony? What have you been up to this week?
I also gave a talk at the Hanslug meeting on Saturday. I gave a talk about...
What was yours about? Because I wasn't there.
I wasn't even going to preempt that. I gave a talk about podcasting. Something.
What do you know about podcasting?
Very little, clearly, including how to set your microphone up properly. Hopefully this week you can actually hear me talking. And I also installed Easy Peasy 1.5, the new release, which is based on Jaunty. That came out in the last week, so I installed that on my netbook and then ordered a RAM upgrade for my netbook.
So what did it come with? Half a gig?
Yes, it comes with half a gig.
And what have you gone up to?
I've ordered another gig. It's one of these ones where you have to dismantle the whole thing to get to the RAM slot, which is on the underside of the motherboard. But it just was swapping so much.
That's what you get for buying a cheap laptop in Asda.
But it was swapping so much, which the previous release didn't do, so I'm not quite sure what the change is.
Hmm.
But I also then reinstalled a few days later and set the encrypted home up. Because I found on Dustin Kirkland's blog the little command line switch that you boot with to enable that option in the GUI installer. And
so go on.
I was going to say, and you felt the performance didn't suffer enough as it was.
Well, that's it. It was pretty bad before, and it just got a little bit worse.
So have you done the eCryptFS thing that encrypts individual files, or have you done the encrypted partition?
No, it encrypts individual files within a hidden directory that then mounts when you log in.
Yeah.
And it encrypts the file names as well.
Yeah.
So I think the structure is the same.
Yeah, that's the same as what I've done on mine. Yeah,
yeah.
Seems to work okay.
But it was nice to be able to do it from within the GUI, and it just sort of gives you a special... Because when Laura and I had quite a big debate about the pluses and the pros and cons of doing it and whether the user should have the choice and all this sort of stuff. And one of the things that I said, well, you know, if you don't realise you've done it and you can accidentally lock yourself out of your disk if you hose your partition or something like that, but it actually gives you a special... unencrypt combination that you're supposed to keep safe somewhere, which is a random alphanumeric string that you keep on a post-it note or something.
I didn't know that.
And then in theory, I guess you can use that to unencrypt your your partition should you need to.
Because on Karmic, there's now, on the release that comes out in October, there's now a button you can press to say, encrypt my home.
Ah, right.
Without passing any strange parameters. It's one of the options now.
Oh, cool.
You had a busy couple of weeks time, I see.
Yeah, someone filed a bug on Launchpad against the screencast site, and because it's not been updated for ages, because I haven't made any screencasts and nobody submitted any, and so it's kind of been a bit slack, so I thought I'd better make some. So I made some.
What was the bug about?
It was this part of the Ubuntu website is out of date.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I thought, well, okay, that's my responsibility somewhat. So
what did you make screencasts about?
Ubuntu.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, one about the boot screen. So your very first experience of seeing Ubuntu is when you put the CD in and turn it on.
Right.
Assuming you're not using Wubi. So I did a thing about a tour of the boot screen and what all the options are.
Oh, right, yes, okay.
Yeah, when you first turn it on and you get to...
Try Ubuntu, install Ubuntu.
Yeah. One about that, one about partitioning, one about how to install and one, the most recent one, was how to screencast, because the idea is not that I should be the one creating all the screencasts, but that I should make a thing that shows other people how to make screencasts. That's the idea.
Cunning.
Seems reasonable to me, yes. Really. So go on then, Simon. What have you been up to?
Nothing.
Ah.
I went to the...
You've had 4 weeks, because you missed the last episode and you've done nothing.
Actually, I was on holiday for 2 weeks.
Did you take your laptop?
I did.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did it work?
Yeah.
Did you use 3G?
Yes.
Did it work?
Yeah, kind of.
Coverage work? Ropey or...?
Actually, I've been doing some experiments with my mobile, and my mobile works better than my modem. I got a dongle.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Is your dongle a 3 dongle?
No, it's not. It's one of the Icon 225s from Orange.
Oh, okay.
I've got a 3-1 and it's causing some grief at the moment.
Oh, dear.
Dongle jaunty. Grief.
Yeah. We should maybe talk about dongles at some point. Maybe not.
There's all sorts of wacky segment titles I'm sure you could come up with for that one. Probably most of them inappropriate for a family show.
Yes, absolutely.
But apart from that, no, not a lot, really.
Cool. That's good.
Yeah.
Everything's worked.
Life.
You're not fighting bugs or having issues with your desktop?
No, I just go, meh, turn it off.
You're just using it.
Indeed.
Excellent.
Oh, well, sounds like a fun-packed show.
Oh, it's not the same.
Nah. Okay, we've got on the line Neil Wallace. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Neil started Open Molar, and I only recently became aware of it and had a little play with it. And I'm not a dentist, and don't look at my teeth.
But Neil presumably is a dentist.
Yes. Right. So, and Neil developed this product called Open Molar, and I wanted to get him on to talk about it. So, the first question is, what is Open Molar and what does it do?
Well, Open Molar really is a pretty typical clone of any standard dental practice management software. It deals with... You know, it's the one and only application we have running in the practice for keeping notes on patients, sending out all our correspondence to patients, doing billing and invoicing, and it's pretty comprehensive in that way, but it doesn't claim to be anything out of the ordinary. It's just a standard dental business app.
Now, so it's more than just the bit where when you're having your teeth checked and they're going upper 6, 4, quadrant missing, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean that's a very it's a key part. You know, dental records are historically very important.
So that's part of it, the dental records. But you also, as you said, you do invoicing and billing and and all that kind of stuff. And you developed it yourself?
Yes, I did.
From scratch?
Pretty much. We had a practice. We first computerized the practice in 1996, and we went with the market leader at the time, and had 12 happy years with them, and then they had a sort of an upgrade, and various things about the way we were treated and the way that application worked and didn't work for me just made me realize that if I was going to be using ropey software that was full of bugs, it might as well be ropey software that's full of bugs that I've written. So to give me a chance to turn them around and fix them, but also I'm a firm believer, given the experience that we've had, that all software needs to be customized. It's essential in a business setting. It needs to be customized so it's as simple as possible for people who are, so that the IT doesn't get in the way, effectively. I'm of the, we've got around about 15 people in the practice using this daily. I'm the only one who would consider myself as a hobbyist in the sort of computer market. Everyone else really doesn't, the less they have to touch the keyboard, the better. So, I'm trying to actually simplify the daily tasks by the way we're doing it. And then, being in there and being able to watch them use it every day gives me a chance to do that.
So were you, you said you developed it, were you developing other stuff before you wrote Open Molar?
I wrote some software. When I was a school kid, I used to use the BBC Micros. I'm 40 this year, so that gives you an idea. I used to mess around programming BBC Micros when I was 12, 13, 14, and then did nothing really with computers because Windows was tedious and it's not a developer's platform. And
that's a bold statement.
But I did want to start writing a few programs again, and I bought a copy of Visual Studio and wrote some small applications in around about 2001, 2002, just to get back into it.
But what kick-started OpenMola? What got you back, really? Because this is quite a bit deeper than throwing together a little app in Visual Studio, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think with programming, from my point of view, I'm a hobby programmer, you find a task, and then you sit and you just pound on it until you've solved that problem. So this was just a kind of a bigger mountain to scale, but it was the same process, you know, I think, right, I want to be able to print a formatted, you know, a business card. How can I get around that? You know, and finding the tools to do it, and Google as your friend, trying to just put things together that way. I don't believe the task is beyond anyone. And personal computing is about having a box which does your bidding. And I think with so many, you know, good applications around, you know, my daughter's taught Word and Excel and PowerPoint. And, They seem to forget that computers are programmable.
So
it's easy to do. It's easy to program these things, and the tools that we've got are fantastic. And if I can do it, I believe anyone can.
So how long have you been working on OpenMola now?
Well, we upgraded this the system that broke on the 5th of November last year.
So it's less than a year.
So it's less than a year.
From start.
From start. I'd done a bit of sort of Python programming before, but really this was the first full-blown GUI application that I've written in Python.
So it's written in Python and use the Qt or Qt or whatever you want to call it,
yeah.
that GUI framework. What made you choose that?
There was an application I was using called Calibra, which is for, it's sort of an ebook library.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and that uses it, and I was always impressed with the look of that application. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was written in Python, so I looked at the code of that, and I also looked at the structure of how, you know, the guy who wrote that is kind of an old Unix nut, and, you know, he's not old, but, you know, he's kind of old school in that all his applications are just a chain of small applications that just do one thing and do it well. And when you look into the way he's laid out his source code, you could see the logic there, so I thought, right, this is a guy who knows what he's doing, that's the toolkit he's chosen, I'll try it. And
that's fair enough.
Also, I think that the you know, I think all the Python toolkits have their strengths, but the huge advantage of the Qt toolkit for Python is the book that's been written, which is, I forget the name of it now, it's a very long book, something like Developing Qt Applications in Python. The 30-word title, which is ridiculous. The book itself is very, very readable. You know, it's almost, you know, it reads almost like a narrative and takes you from start to finish.
And so if you started that in November last year, and it's now October, so nearly a year later.
Yeah.
It's now September, in fact, nearly a year later. And you're now running that software day to day. You've completely replaced your proprietary app with something you've written.
Yeah, we kind of had to in the end. I mean, this was never never the ideal takeover, but, you know, I filed a few bugs on the original program, I think 50, on day two of running this thing.
Whoa.
And had no response, really, to any of those, and some of them are critical, and were affecting our... If you've got bad software, you know, this is dental practice management software, so if you've got bad management software, you've got bad management, by definition. It was affecting the standard of care for our patients, and that was just not acceptable. From day one of running that program, we decided we were going to have to look somewhere else. And I looked at some of the alternatives and was not overly impressed, and just started to write a few modules to overcome the shortcomings of what the proprietary application did. And that ultimately is what led us into the full-blown application we've got at the moment. You know, we cut the license on that. Our license to run that application ran out in April. So since April, we've been running OpenMola in the practice.
And have you found other practices who've been interested in the work you've done? Have you passed it on to other dentist practices?
I've shown a couple of dentists it, and they're quite interested. But I wouldn't be too happy to actually push it out to them. I think what I want to do is build the thing, get it absolutely solid. Now, I think I've got to have it running in my practice bug-free for 18 months before I'd even consider pushing it onto someone, just because it is such a critical application.
Do you think that's attainable, 18 months bug-free software?
No. Okay, let me go back. I think once I've been running it 18 months with relatively few problems.
Right.
I think then I could, with hand on heart and conscience clear, go to other people and say, right, this software does what your current package does, but this is free software, it's modifiable, and, it has all the benefits in kind. So, once another practice starts using it, that brings in issues. I mean, it would be great to get some more feedback and ideas about features and how they could change, rather than it being just driven by me and my practice. There would be a downside to the, I would then have to think whenever I make a change, if I've got to be 100% certain it's not going to break whatever data they've got in their schema.
Yeah.
You're all aware, there's a big difference between theory and practice when it comes to software, and it's very heavily tested. I have my own, I run it on my laptop, which has got a kind of a full trial version of the software, but it's also got my real data, which makes the application a completely different beast, if you change what's in the database at the back end. And I've just had a gentleman join the project. I don't know if the project's hosted on Launchpad.
Yeah.
I've just had a gentleman join the project who found it on there, and he's a DBA by profession, and he's really enthusiastic about the fact that this is GPL, et cetera, et cetera, and is going to help me completely rewrite the schema, which I'm quite excited about. I've rewritten a few of the tables, but I originally wanted to keep the schema the same for a variety of reasons. One, that it meant that this company here had annoyed me so much. I originally thought, I had a duty to sort of get vengeance against them, and if I kept the exact same schema, I could...
Or make it easy for people to transition.
Okay. However, with passage of time, I realised that schema is a lot of the issue.
Right.
And, it's actually holding me back more than, giving me that opportunity.
Do you find that other dentists that you talk to understand the reasons why you did it, sort of the benefits of the open source free software asset, or do they just see it as yet another piece of software?
I think the latter.
Do you think
there's a huge lack of understanding for open source, and I think most dentists have had such a torrid time from IT companies that as soon as you start talking about IT, they just glaze over. They're used to being... You've got to remember that what they get attacked by salespeople. If I went along as I did to the BDA conference in Glasgow this year, there were probably six or seven companies there with big, glossy stalls and reps trying to pull you in and tell you that they've got the greatest and the latest, etc., etc.
Do you think the fact that you're less keen to get other people involved in using your software might be potentially hampering your ability to gain community adoption, and without community adoption you're restricting your ability to say, hey, look at the great community behind this, and look, there's no single corporation, because at the moment you are the person behind it and you're pretty much the only person behind it, aren't you?
I think you're absolutely right there, Alan. My philosophy is, however, that initially, I went out all guns blazing. This is going to be the best thing since sliced bread. Come on, jump over, have a go at this, etc.
Yeah.
And then I realised that people will take a look at it as soon as you do that. But they'll take a look, and they'll make an opinion, and they'll clear off if it's not exactly right. I think, sadly, that the market for this type of application is only for a mature product.
Mm. Yeah, you couldn't have done the song and dance about it, July last year when it was in embryonic stage,
absolutely,
perhaps. But you already run it on your practice, and you run your practice with that software.
Yeah.
So it's clearly good enough, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
I guess you don't want to spend half your time doing support for other practices as well, though.
Well, I don't know. It's just as lucrative.
Yeah, I was going to say, there is money in support, that's for sure.
Now, that's quite interesting. I was going to ask you guys this. I am the sole IT support for the practice at the moment, and that makes me horrendously uncomfortable for a variety of reasons. One is that I'm not an IT professional. I'm just a hobbyist, and although I can set up networks, etc.
I think you do yourself a disservice to say you're a hobbyist to develop a platform that your dentist practice runs on. But yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I get your point.
Okay, but I think with computers, the more you know, the more you realise you don't know.
Yeah.
You know, the sysadmin side of things is totally and utterly beyond me. I think, you know, compared to I can think logically and do the programming side of things, but you know, the sort of support calls that just drive you mad. You know, you get sort of a disk not found error on your server or something along those lines, and you know, if that happens, if I'm there, I can fix it in no time, and I know I've got a spare server up in the thing, and I've just got to plug it in and reconfigure Wicked so it's got the right IP and et cetera, et cetera. There's no one else who could do that,
but it sounds
for
like,
me or in the practice.
So it sounds like you need some kind of support infrastructure for, well, that just sounds like, you know, your average tech support, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. I really need people who are, there's two ways to support this product. There are going to be people who would, if you were supporting OpenMola now, you'd get someone who would ring you and say, I've got Mrs. Jones in the chair, she's got a bridge, I've tried to charge it, it won't come up with the right amount, what have I done wrong? You know, that takes a intimate knowledge of the product itself or the application itself. But then there's the other type where it could be someone like myself who rings in and saying, right, I can't get the application running, why not? And that, you know, there are two very distinct levels of.
And is that the scary thing? Is that if it went out there to other practices, you'd have to support that, even though you know that as a community project, as an open source project, anyone could technically support it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to the day when someone does come on board and just say, right, I like what you've done with this. Let's try and get a business going around it. My itch that I've had to scratch was to, you know, without this software, my practice wouldn't be able to run.
Right.
So, you know, it has value to me. Before I was paying, and was quite happy to pay, about £500 a month to support the previous application.
Oh, wow. Yeah, but then again, how much does it cost you in development time to create this product?
Oh, I mean, it's immeasurable.
Yeah.
It is totally immeasurable. Well, it is measurable, but it's,
you
know, it's something that would be very painful to do. However, I even now, having an intimate knowledge of the program and how my network is set up, I would quite happily put someone on the payroll at the practice to come in and do, you know, take that load off me. I'm away, you know, if I'm away on holiday for a couple of weeks, and we get a router blow, you know, it's uncertain to me exactly who's going to sort that out.
Yeah. But that's, like I say, that's your average tech support. You know, I think it's been great having you on. I don't know, are you coming to Lug Radio Live and perhaps Odd Camp?
I would very much like to. I think the Odd Camp sounds very exciting. You know, just the, you know, I think sometimes you get more out of a 10-minute speech than you do from an hour talk. Well, so I would very much like to. I'm not absolutely certain I'm going to be there.
Well, if you are there, you're more than welcome to give a talk about OpenMola and also about your experience in Python and Qt development. That would be fantastic.
And the support for small businesses in open source projects as well.
That's practically a full day, really, isn't it?
you don't have to do all of those, obviously.
Laura, with that in mind, I would actually just say that, you know, when you're starting out a project like this, you do make certain choices that you often go on to regret. You know, you choose a language and you think, oh, I would have had an easier time in this language. You choose a toolkit, you choose a database, you choose a hosting provider, and touch wood, I am thrilled to bits with the choices I've made. Launchpad in particular and the Bizarre stuff is just first class.
So if people want to find out more about OpenMola, where do they go?
Well, I blog about it. I've got a blog at Blogspot. I've got there's a wiki that I've just started because I have, as I mentioned earlier, I've got Stephen Smith coming in as a sort of a very important co-developer. So we've started a wiki so that we can document what each other is.
Oh, excellent. But it's hosted on Launchpad.
All of these are linked to from the Launchpad site, which is launchpad.net/OpenMola.
Magic. I'll put a link to that in our show notes.
Thank you very much.
It's been fantastic having you on. Thanks for talking about
it. Yeah, sounds like a really good project for you to have got your teeth into.
Oh,
indeed. And if any of your listeners would be kind enough just to... There is a deb available linked to from that Launchpad site. If anyone would just install it and get back to me with any problems during the installation.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's been, you know, that could be, you know, an absolute dead end for people when I do try and push the application out.
Yeah. Absolutely. Fantastic.
Thank you. Thanks,
Neil.
Thank you for having me on.
Take care.
See you. Bye.
time for the news, and Microsoft have confirmed that they've provided a set of training slides to Best Buy employees to teach them the so-called benefits of Windows over Linux netbooks.
Mm. There's been a bit of an outcry about these slides.
There's a whole series of kind of crosses saying, support applications, cross against Linux, and a tick next to Windows.
Yeah, and support hardware devices. They've worded it very cunningly.
Oh, yeah.
But, it's mostly accurate, unfortunately.
Yep. Yeah.
I don't know, some of the things are really not that accurate.
Well, they say it doesn't support a lot of hardware, which is actually less the case.
No, it's not. Cunningly worded.
The implication is that Linux doesn't support a lot of hardware.
Exactly. Yes.
The actual minutiae.
But this is Best Buy. It's like going to PC World.
Yeah, which is where people buy computers.
Selling you a computer.
Yeah, but people do. People walk into Dixon's, PC World, that's where they buy the computer. If they're not tech savvy, they're going to listen to someone who spouts a bit of knowledge.
Well, it just comes back to whether or not Ubuntu is ready for the general public on the desktop, which is another
good question.
Debate entirely.
Amazon have disabled Isle of Miro's referral account because of the Firefox extension, which, when installed and you buy something from Amazon, automatically contributes referral fees to the Miro project.
Yeah, it was quite cute. No, it was good. It was you opt in. You install
really?
It. Yeah, it's a thing you put on your Firefox, so that if you're ever browsing around the web and then you go to Amazon and you end up buying something, instead of the referral going nowhere, it goes to Miro.
So why do Amazon have a problem with that?
Against the T's and C's.
Yeah, I started trying to read the T's and C's and spot which bit, and I gave up. I think it's something to do with the fact that it's coming from not a direct link from their website.
Mm.
I would guess from some of the things they said.
Yeah, it's a shame because it's a very easy way to contribute. You know, just install an extension and then forget about it because it doesn't cost you anything extra. It's a shame. Apple have released libdispatch, the library that provides the implementation of the Grand Central Dispatch services under an Apache license.
You know, Grand Central is all to do with multi-core optimizations. So it's all about making applications that aren't designed to run on lots of cores. Run on lots of cores and be quicker and stuff.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
That does annoy me. I've got the little thing at the top of the screen that tells me how my CPUs are busy, and I've got two cores, and it only ever seems to be 50% busy.
Yeah, because the apps aren't written multi-threaded.
Yeah, it makes me sad.
I don't know whether this stuff will ever get into Linux or whether it's compatible with the Linux kernel or whatever, but, you know, it's nice to see Apple contributing stuff under open source licenses.
And finally, Motorola has announced its first Android phone, the Click, which will go to T-Mobile in the UK.
And Orange, I guess, if they merge.
Yeah.
If
works for me.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the HTC when my contract expires. Meh.
So, what platforms have we got in the room? I've got a Symbian phone. What have you got?
Windows Mobile.
Yours is a Windows Mobile. Yeah. Tony, what's
mine's
yours?
Whatever my Samsung U600 runs.
Oh, so it's some
proprietary Samsung thing.
Okay. And you're on a Nokia. You're Symbian as well. Hmm. So none of us use free software platforms.
I didn't buy my phone for the software. I bought my phone for the hardware keyboard, which I now don't like.
Win there.
And I look after my phones. So when I buy a phone,
there
were no open source phones when I bought this one.
Despite the fact they don't work abroad,
It works fine abroad now.
It does a different picture every time you go to a different country.
It's a brilliant phone.
Fantastic.
It's like a teenage girl's phone.
So we've got some events coming up. Software Freedom Day this year, in a new all-shortened events section, because it was getting a bit long. So we're only going to read the things that are coming up before the next episode now. So Software Freedom Day is Saturday, 19th of September, this Saturday.
And you're doing something on that day.
For Os Bar Camp.
Sorry,
which is the
just
next
screwed
line.
That up. Yeah.
Laura and I are going to Os Bar Camp. We don't know whether Dave is going to Os Bar Camp. You remember in the last episode?
Being all enigmatic,
isn't it?
Might be, might not. Little bit elusive, little bit Paul Sladenish.
I think I'll come down from the ceiling on a rope like a ninja.
Good if he turns up on a bike.
Yeah, better not be my Brompton, though. That's
and he'll be sleeping in your hotel room on the floor.
He won't.
Yes, Os Bar Camp's this weekend in Dublin as well.
And I'm doing a lightning talk.
Excellent. What about?
About InfoSlicer.
Ah, excellent. So you practice on Hanslug. Do it for real.
Pretty much. CMS Node Simple Geek Moot 2009 is on the 26th and 27th of September at the Workstation Sheffield, UK.
And finally, Launchpad Community Meetup is on the 28th of September 2009 in London. And we'll put a link on the...
I'll probably be going to that.
Are we?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, should be good in London. It seems like quite a few people are going, actually. Cool. Well, a few people have said on Facebook, yes, instead of no or maybe, which means nothing.
And you'll be there with your
next. It means exactly everything. Everybody will turn up. It has to mean that.
Yes, that's exactly it.
It's time for the latest news about OkaCamp, and Dan from the Linux Outlaws has put together a trailer for it, and it features everybody here. Well, apart from Simon, sorry. Apart from Simon. Right,
features, apart from him, apart from that bloke there.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
It features some of the Ubuntu UK podcast team and all and of some the some Linux of Outlaws, Outlaws team. Let's play it now.
Oi! Our theme's better!
No, it's not.
I think you've broken it now.
Guys, maybe we should get on with the promo?
Are you wondering what you're going to do with that spare day after Lug Radio Live this year?
So were we.
But then we had a brainwave.
I wondered what that burning smell was.
Why not run a joint Barcamp-esque event nearby on the Sunday?
So nearby, in fact, that it'll be in the Connaught Hotel in Wolverhampton, the official Lug Radio Live hotel.
It's called Og Camp. No, not Odd Camp. That's Og with two G's.
Odd Camp might be more appropriate, though.
There'll be all kinds of talks going on during the afternoon. You can talk too if you want to.
Plus, there'll be a live recording from each podcast in the main room.
Ubuntu UK and Linux Outlaws under one roof.
So put it in your diaries now. Sunday, October 25th at the Connaught Hotel in Wolverhampton.
Visit ogcamp.org for full details.
Sounds like a fun-packed event.
I love that.
That is very cool. Very good.
Laura's Dan did a fantastic job.
He has. Laura's got a funny colour. But yeah, that's about says it all, really. There's some stuff to update everybody on. We've confirmed the opening times now. So we're going to say doors are opening at 10:30 with a short welcome at 10:45. The first session's probably will start at 11 as we advertised originally.
Mm-hmm.
Check out the Lug Radio Live website for details about the hotel rooms at the Connaught. The Lug Radio Live website has been launched now, so yes, it's all there in its Spectrum-like goodness.
We've got some sponsors as well.
Yeah.
We need to thank them.
Very much.
Bitfolk.
Good old Bitfolk.
Yay. Open Learning Centre.
Yes.
Who we interviewed in...
Earlier this season, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was episode 6.
The Two Adams.
And Canonical are providing some prizes.
Yep.
Yep.
And... we've got a media sponsor. A media partner.
Media partner.
Media partner, got to get the terminology right. Yeah. Who are the very helpful guys at Linux Format.
Cool.
Fantastic.
We are still looking for more sponsors, though. Well, why
never
not? So if you are interested in sponsoring the event, please look on the ogcamp.org website, and there's my email address on there. Send me an email.
Actually, there's one sponsor we forgot. Viglin.
Ah, yes. Well, they're just being confirmed now. Viglin have offered to send us a couple of Air Viglin NPCLs to give away at the event.
Yes.
So come along and see if you can get your hands on one.
Fantastic. What else do we need?
We need some crew.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
So if you fancy volunteering to come and help make sure the rooms run on time, please email us at the usual... podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
Yeah, that'll do.
Yeah. It's like you've never said it before. What are we after?
We are still after a couple more projectors as well. So if you're coming along and have access to a digital projector, preferably one that does at least 1024x768, then please.
Yeah,
let
we
us
only
know.
Want to borrow it. We're not going to drop.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I suppose we need to just make sure everybody's happy that we're going to look after them. They're not really left in hotel rooms for anybody to walk in and pick up and walk away with.
That's so, part of the role of the crew is to make sure the stuff doesn't go walkies or anything like that.
Yeah, we've had one offered to us, so we are for a couple more, one for each of the rooms. Job's
that'd
good.
Be fantastic.
Yeah, and hopefully you'll come along and we'll see you on the 25th.
Mm, more details at ogcamp.org.
We received a submission this week for... Go on, Simon, you say it. You've got the best voice.
Come on, line love.
Yeah, here's a submission.
Baby.
Hi, this is Alan Bell from the Open Learning Centre, bringing you some command line love. All the command line programs and their dazzling array of switches are beautifully documented in the manual pages, which can be called up with the man command. So, for example, man ls will show you the manual page for the ls command. It displays the help right in front of the command prompt you're working at, which to my mind is the most inconvenient place it could possibly be. With the help of a little script and an alias line in your bash rc file, more details on that in the show notes, you can replace the regular man command with a call to launch the GNOME Help application in the background, and that will open the man page that you requested. So this means you can type man ls as usual, but you get your cursor straight back, and GNOME Help pops up beside the command prompt so you can refer to it as you work. It looks a lot prettier too. Hope that helps, and I look forward to seeing lots of you at the Og Camp.
Thank you very much indeed, Alan.
I tried that. It works really well. My microphone's not on, is it?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm just talking quietly. I tried it. It works. It's really good.
That's very cool.
It is. It kind of breaks if you do man and then something that doesn't exist, because GNOME then has a fit where it can't find the man page that doesn't exist.
Right.
But if you do man ls, yeah, you get a nice graphical window.
And presumably it works for other man pages, not just the...
No. It's specific to man ls. It's the only command.
There are a lot of flags.
Yes. That's good.
Yeah, I mean, I know exactly what he meant. As soon as he said about, it opens right in front of you, which is the last place you actually want to be able to do it. And the number of times I've had man pages running in different screen sessions or using like Terminator with multiple tabs and things and flicking backwards and forwards trying to work out what's going on.
Yeah.
It sounds like a really useful solution.
It is. Of course, only applicable if you're on a desktop and not...
I think the script he's got detects whether you're running on a desktop.
And really?
If you're not, it just calls the standard man format.
Yeah. Oh, we'll put that in the show notes. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Although you're out of a job now, Simon.
Well, actually, I think it's great that Alan's sent in the contribution, and I look forward to other people doing exactly the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Send us in your command line love. We had an email from Callum Craig saying, I would like to contribute to the community a bit. My knowledge is not good enough to really give technical support to anyone, and I can't code, so I can't do any development. So I was thinking about getting involved with the documentation, as I reckon I can write fairly well, and I would most likely understand whatever issues I would be writing about. Now, this is a really good question, because documentation is something that the community always needs, but is perhaps not very glamorous to get involved with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, Simon, you've got involved in documentation before, haven't you?
He's not very glamorous.
No.
Oh, that's harsh.
Yeah.
Just because you've got a soft voice.
I did documentation for 7 years. It's not glamorous.
Yeah. No, it's not. It's definitely worthwhile. I like Biobu. We've been through Biobu a number of times.
Yeah, screen profiles thing.
And the fact is that there was very little in the man page. So, I just thought, well... It needs a man page, because that's, in theory, the first place you should go to look to see how it works. So I just looked into how it works, and I got on to one of the developers, Dustin, and said, do you want any help? And he said, well, yeah. And it was as simple as that.
Write me a man page.
And what did you have to do? Was it just like open up a text editor, start typing, and email it to him? Or was that how?
No.
Are there many tools and processes you have to learn to be able to get that?
Really, text editor. Went to Launchpad. Downloaded the latest version and edited the man page file with a text editor.
And there's a template for the man page files, is there?
There is.
Right.
Good luck finding it.
Well, surely, you could, if you rummage around in some man pages, you could have a look at what another one looks like and rip off the formatting, I guess, because most of them look the same.
The thing is that, certainly in Dustin's case, he knew exactly what he wanted with a man page.
Mm. Right.
And therefore, my first attempt was a complete rewrite.
Right.
The problem with that is that it would have taken him a long time to check and work through, and he's a busy guy.
Mm.
And so it needed small changes.
Right.
Small change, push it, small change, push it. So,
So who were you writing the man page for? What sort of audience did you have in mind?
New users. Right. Somebody who came along and wanted to know what it does and how to do it.
Right.
I must admit that I've been slacking recently, but that's another matter.
I mean, it's not finished yet.
But man pages, of course, aren't the only way that you can contribute to a documentation effort.
No, I mean, the man pages are great for command line fans, as we've talked about before, and with Alan Bell's little whizzy thing, it can be good for the GUI people as well. But, I mean, the website is one of the first areas that people will see in relation to a project.
Yeah, I mean, when someone needs help with something, what are they going to do? What does your average user do? Well, they don't read documentation, do they? Because nobody knows. For the vast majority of them, they don't. But what they might do is search for error messages or search for the name of the product or something, relating to what they want to do and the name of the product. And that will usually turn up something like a forum post, a wiki page, or the official documentation.
I must admit, whenever I've had problems with Ubuntu, I've stuck something in a search engine and come up with usually an Ubuntu forums post. Now, I'm not a forums fan, I'm not a forums user, but there are a lot of people who are trying to do similar things. And
there is a vast amount of information in the forums. Yeah. People write how-tos, they write documentation on how to, you know, fix your video drivers and how to, you know, install certain packages and so on.
Does any of that stuff ever get pulled over to the official Ubuntu help pages?
Well, the implication by you saying official is that the forums aren't official.
Well, they're the official forums, but...
not the official documentation, though.
Because isn't there wiki.ubuntu.com and help.ubuntu.com or something?
The official documentation site is help.ubuntu.com. That's where all the help documentation is. Now, within that, there's... if you go to that URL, help.ubuntu.com, that's where you get to the main documentation. Now, that's created by the doc team, the documentation team.
Okay.
And that's fairly well regimented in the way that it's structured. Mm. But there's also, if you go to help.ubuntu.com/community, is a wiki for documentation. So that's less structured, more freeform.
Right.
If you see what I mean. Like, you know, a wiki page would be.
I've never been involved with an open source documentation project, but I was a technical writer for a company for 7 years, and I went to a KDE documentation project talk at FOSDEM a couple of years ago, and it was really interesting how similar what they did was to how we've done it in a company for years.
Did you find that surprising?
I did because it was a community voluntary effort, and I just kind of thought it would be done differently. I think now it's probably because the people who start the project or are in charge of the project are technical writers privately as well, commercially. Right. But even the problems that I had, like translating screenshots, it's a nightmare of a problem because you have to be able to bring it up in every language. And in a company, you do maybe 9 languages as standard, but in Ubuntu, it's just incredible numbers.
Klingon.
And because they were a community, they could bring up, like, different people could bring their skills to it, and they came up with this fantastic script that automatically recorded the setup and did it zillions of times and threw all the output into CVS. And it's just like, wow, that's really cool. And all the processes are the same, and... if you're into, you don't have to be writing the English documentation, you could be doing translation, you could be helping with the process. And I think one of the things he said is that because a lot of people aren't into using HTML or XML and things that it gets produced in, they do what Simon did and write in a text editor, and then somebody else who knows how to use the tools can convert it to the right tools ready for translation and production.
Yeah, that's the thing, because if it doesn't really matter which avenue you go down. If you go down the man page route, there's obviously a specific formatting for that.
Yep.
If you were to look at help.ubuntu.com, that documentation is written using DocBook, I believe. I don't know if they're moving to a different format. I believe the GNOME project's moving to a different format. But at the moment, it's DocBook. If you go to help.ubuntu.com/community, that's a wiki, and that's a completely different format again. Mm. And then if you write something on the forums, it's yet another, you know, the forum markup is different from the wiki. So what you tend to find is you get these silos of people. You get people who contribute to man pages, people who contribute to forums, people who go to the wiki, and people who contribute to the doc team. It doesn't tend to be people who contribute across all of those, which is why there's a massive difference in the quality, style, and quantity of documentation in those 4 different areas, which is an issue.
Mm. Yeah. There's also different types of documentation. So we talked about man pages, which are very kind of factual. It's almost listing, aren't they, the different options?
Yeah. Sort of reference information, isn't it?
And you have to give examples and things, I think.
Yeah.
So you've got that sort of thing. And then you've got sort of how-tos and things, which may have a few technical commands in it and perhaps a little bit of explanation. You might get full-on tutorials, which have a lot of explanation, quite wordy, and then something like an FAQ, which essentially is, here's a question or an error message, and here's 2 sentences saying what to do when you get it. Now, I guess the barrier to entry on things like an FAQ is fairly low.
As soon as you have a bit of knowledge about an answer to a question, you can contribute.
But perhaps the expectation of somebody writing a tutorial is that they've got fairly good skills in whatever language they're writing the tutorial in. So
also about how to educate people. I mean, tutorial's a different type of activity to do than it is to read a
how to, for instance.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, whether it's just something that comes from practice or.
There are some well structured ways of formulating those kind of formatted documents, whether it's instructional guides or training type instructional guides or FAQs, and they're way beyond what I've looked at. But I know there are teams within Ubuntu who are looking to improve those areas of documentation, and I know they need help. They certainly need help. We can certainly put links in the show notes to each of the different areas and where people can get started with each of the areas, like pointing people to the beginners team in the Ubuntu forums and the doc team in the for the documentation.
But a written documentation isn't the only way to help people out. I mean,
I can see this is galloping over a hill towards me.
I mean, we did talk about them earlier, but I mean, people can just look at contributing screencasts and things. It's not that difficult to do.
Oh, really?
It isn't. I remember doing a whole series of them.
You did loads of them, didn't you?
Even some of which eventually got published.
They all did.
Well, you say that. They're not on the website.
Oh, thanks, Tony.
That people can contribute screencasts in the Ubuntu case, to screencast.ubuntu.com.
Yeah, or people can just create their own YouTube channel or whatever. Absolutely. And there are plenty of people out there who do that and are very successful in creating a community like their Show Me Do, for example.
Yes.
They've got a massive library of tutorial videos.
Yeah.
And for some people who don't want to read a man page, even though the man page contains exactly the same information as a video tutorial, some people get more from a video tutorial than they will from a piece of text.
Even if it's just a video of a command line prompt.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe video of a man page scrolling up the screen. There's got to be something in that.
I think that's the important thing, that all the different formats all have their place, and them all the same. And even things like the style and the tools and things, I mean, there are good reasons why they'll use DocBook, or like I use DitterXML, which is another open standard, and it aids translation. It means you can do a lot of computer processing of it automatically that you can't do with just free text.
Mm.
But then, as you say, like, most people won't want to bother learning those tools. So.
Yeah.
Well, maybe Callum should approach somebody like Neil. And talk to him about OpenMola.
Yeah, about
actually, does he need documentation? And it will be up to Neil to decide what he's after, whether it's man pages or web pages or something like that.
Yeah, so that's a good idea. Finding something that's not well documented.
Absolutely. A new or relatively new project that you can get involved in at the next stage.
You resisted doing the get your teeth into joke again.
I did.
Yeah, I think that our conclusion is there that we really think documentation is important and it can help make life a lot easier.
And we'll point people to the right place.
Get on and do it.
Welcome to the Ubuntu Eco thing.
Like it. Good.
Sounds good.
What's up, Laura?
Ubuntu 1 has moved from ubuntu1.com to 1.ubuntu.com.
I know it doesn't sound like a big thing, like moving from one URL to another, but this came out after a massive discussion with the community council about the naming of the product. And do you remember all of that?
And I heard some people being sort of very difficult and kept telling them to move from Ubuntu 1.com to 1.ubuntu.com. Is that right, Alan?
No, I just made... no. I just offered it as an option.
And they took
I wasn't being difficult.
So it's entirely thanks to you that this has happened.
Yes, that's right. Okay. Yes.
Well done.
Scott James Remnant has called for people willing to test the new Ubuntu boot stuff in Ubuntu Karmic.
Now, this is the stuff to make it quicker.
Well, it's the stuff building up to the stuff to make it quicker.
Right.
Because the stuff to make it quicker is not in this release. The stuff that
right.
make... Because the target was 10-second boot, wasn't it? But that's not for this one. That's for 10.04 or 10.10 and so on. What this is stuff like replacing the boot splash thing, which was USplash. And on Fedora, we've mentioned they use Plymouth.
Yes.
We're going to use XSplash. So we're going to start X very early on in the boot up process. And Scott's stuff, he's got a PPA and loads of instructions on how to test it all out. So I tried it out on my laptop.
And did it do the whole boot chart thing where you can see what's taking up how many seconds of boot time?
And that's what he wants, actually, is the results of running boot charts. Right. So he can see the difference before and after of what changes he's made. And it's not made any difference to my machine from a speed point of view. But I did have a bit of a problem the other day in that I booted up after doing all of this stuff. And it booted up just a black screen. And I thought, oh dear. But it was just the regular disk check thing that was happening in the background. Oh. But he hasn't written the thing that shows that on the screen yet. So, yeah, I was panicking slightly. Yeah. Just a disk light on permanently.
Oh, yeah, I can see why that would be slightly worrying.
Yes.
Ubuntu's had its 2009 report card. Apparently it gets an A for hardware support, but a D for appearance. People still don't like brown, do they?
Yeah, this is Tanner Helland, who's written a blog post about it, and he's gone through...
It's a really good article.
Yeah, it is. It's quite long, but it's worth taking the time to read through it. And he's gone through and graded various different aspects of Ubuntu from A through to, A, B, C, D, and F, presumably for fail. but nothing actually got an F, which is pretty good going, I guess. And he's reviewed...
It's a very glass half full kind of point of view there. Well, we didn't fail. Okay.
I'm target oriented. But he's assessing the difference between 8.04 and 9.04. So a year's worth of development.
Okay.
And he sort of thinks the hardware support's brilliant, the appearance, not so much. And he's got screenshots of Mac OS X and Windows 7 and Ubuntu 9.04, and says which one of these looks like it was designed in 1995.
And then there's a screenshot of 504 from like eons ago.
Yeah, hoary hedgehog.
And it doesn't actually look that different.
No,
he says different wallpaper.
That's about it.
Yeah, that's about it. Slightly more orange, I guess. But new features and innovations, he gives a B. So things like 3G network support, guest account, system janitor, encrypted private directory, and notification system and X4 support and things. He rates pretty highly.
It's very subjective, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, you know, for me, if I went through that same list, I'd probably give it quite a high score in some ways, and I'm not particularly fussed about what it looks like. You've seen all my machines, they're all the standard default look, and I'm looking across at Laura's and hers is as well.
Mm. And the real key is how it compares with other distros.
Well, you know, is it really?
Well,
we don't really want to take people away from Fedora and Arch, and we want to take people away from Windows and OS X, surely.
No, but it would be a worry if you were doing worse than Fedora.
I don't think we're doing worse than Fedora.
No, but if I'm not saying we are, but if we were, it would be a worry. If we're doing better than every other Linux distribution out there, then we'd be best of breed.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be interesting to see, you know, what you would think of other distros.
Yeah, that's fair point. Yeah.
That's my point. And that's all we've got in the eco thing this time.
It's time for your feedback. James has taken issue with my title for our Ubuntu community segment. He writes,
ecosystem, a biosphere. Ecosphere is just a made-up word. Yeah, a quick Google for it turns up ecosphere is trademarked too. Interesting.
Oh dear.
Oh. For both reasons, Gerald is a more valid name, apparently.
Well, we asked,
school
actually.
School here, didn't it?
We did, yeah, it told me. Yeah. We actually asked via the Identica, the Twitter and the Facebook. That's really hard to say, those.
The definite articles.
Yes. What people thought we should do about this. And we had some replies, didn't we, Laura?
We did. Techno Viking said, don't end the debate, it's hilarious.
Thanks, Mike.
He really cares as long as we keep going.
Well, you know, it populates at 2 minutes of our podcast. So it's easy content.
Yeah, someone, we're short of content, clearly.
Someone else, Nightwise on Twitter, said Ubuntu underbelly.
Ooh. Mm. Liam Wilson says George. And Bill McMahon. Oh, God, I've mispronounced that.
Bill.
Bill. Says Ubuntu Sphere.
Oh.
Matt B90 also says Ubuntu Sphere.
No, that's two votes. Oh,
we can't have consensus.
Eric Johnson goes for the practical approach.
Right.
And says, why not just call it community news?
Ah, I see what he's done there.
Yeah. He's been all sensible and everything.
He has, yeah.
I'll never catch on.
Ben Fox calls it elephant.
Okay.
He's gone a bit hat stand there.
Well, it was so massive.
Ben Pritchard said Vera. I thought, didn't we have Vera?
No.
I think we floated it as an idea 1 week.
Ah, okay.
I don't think Vera ever made it to air.
And finally, Dave Mark Robert Morley.
Oh, himself. This has got to be good.
Suggested the Ubuntu bog roll. I think that's a play on blog roll.
Blog roll.
Yeah.
I hope so. Oh, Dave.
Thanks,
Dave. Maybe we could do merchandise and everything.
That could really go badly.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Declan McGrath from the Code Mongrel podcast asks,
how do you publish separate feeds for each format type? Is this handled by the PodPress plugin that you use?
Yes, it is, and it's quite painful.
This is your secret sauce, though, isn't it, Alan?
It's the thing I do, yeah, is publish the pages and get it wrong every week.
Oh, yeah, what was the last episode?
Last episode was season 1, episode 12, not season 2, episode 12. Yeah, basically, we've got WordPress and we've got the PodPress add-on, and every time we release a show, we create 5 pages. One which is the main page, which you see on the front page of the website, and then 4 more pages. Each one of those goes into a different category. Og high, og low, MP3 high, MP3 low, and that gives us our 5 feeds, the main one and then those 4. And that's it.
So PodPress doesn't do a huge amount. It's actually the fact that you have to create 5 posts for each episode.
Yeah, that's the pain.
And put them in different categories.
And actually get it wrong on every single one of them. In subtly different ways, it seems to be.
So if someone can write a new plugin, would that be helpful?
Well, Dave keeps promising to throw some Django love at this. Yes. But we've yet to see it.
Scary.
Yeah. All about the Django.
It's all happening. I'm sure he's working on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, while he's not here.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what he's doing right now. Ross Anderson takes issue with our segment on software snobbery.
Your discussion on snobbery caused me some problems because I'm not really interested in all this sudo and get stuff. I just want a computer that runs quickly and does everything I want it to. So it was a little galling to hear an undercurrent of, if you're not using the command line, then maybe you should be using Windows.
Who said that?
It was Dave.
It was Dave. And in fact, I felt a little bit guilty because me and Alan sort of had a go at him. So I don't think there was much of an undercurrent, really.
Yeah, actually, that did get a bit heated.
It was really quite not about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But absolutely, so I don't think that's our consensus in general,
not at all. Although, having said that, I did have to use the command line recently in order to support someone, and if I didn't have certain command line skills, there's no way I would have been able to help this person. So, yeah, there is a place for it, but not for everyone.
Jonathan Thomas sent us a video response to our mention of the OpenShot video editor. We'll link to it in the show notes.
That's really cool.
It is.
Very cool.
It's fantastic. We've had a video response. That's fantastic. And it's edited in his own product, an open source video editor.
And it's really neat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I will have to give it a go, OpenShot video editor. Because I think it's basically the comments that you and I made that got picked out more than anybody else, isn't it?
Okay.
Such as believe it when we see it and do we really need another video editor?
And the best comment in there was, in his video response, was something along the lines of, no bugs were found during the making of this video, which is something to be said, really.
Yeah, no, I shall give it a go for my next video project, I think.
Patrick Archibald sent us a Just a Moment.
I recently discovered the xdg-open command. This command opens a file or a URL in the user's preferred application. If a URL is provided, it will be open in the user's preferred web browser. I use keyboard shortcuts to open my webmail, my intranet, my web RSS reader, and other frequently visited websites. To configure the shortcuts, I use gconf-editor or compiz config settings manager if I have compiz turned on. Lately, I've been using Chromium as my browser. Since Chromium is under heavy development, it occasionally becomes unusable, and I have to switch back to Firefox. I was hard coding the browser command in my keyboard shortcut bindings. This became problematic with frequent browser hopping. I now use the xdg-open command when defining my keyboard shortcuts. When switching browsers, I don't have to update each keyboard binding command. I just change my default browser using the menu system. I click System, Preferences, Preferred Applications, and change the web browser. All my shortcuts open the browser of the month.
There we go.
Loads of information in there.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
That's great. Yeah.
I've never used that. I am aware of XDG as a something somewhere. But,
yeah.
Oh, we're not allowed to talk about it, are we?
No. Well, we are. He's not allowed to.
Oh, yes.
And he can't because he's obviously not here and he's somewhere in America. But the preferred
That's really cool. Thank you for sending indeed. That in, Jen.
Thank you, Patrick. And the preferred applications thing, I've never looked at before. And I usually use Thunderbird as my mail client. And it annoys me when I click on a link in a mail to link in
Did
a web page.
Did you never know about that?
I just never looked. So I had a little look and thought, oh, look, I can select Thunderbird. Ding.
As your preferred mail client?
As my preferred mail client.
You're too busy playing with the command line. That's what that is.
Yeah.
All about the
you need to learn a bit more about the GUI. Snob.
James H. Fox emailed in about the YouTube Perfect Script Alan mentioned in the last episode.
I caught this recommendation on the last episode, and it has been the greatest headache alleviator I've come across in ages. You see, my wife's iMac has never gotten along very well with Flash. YouTube has been miserable to try and watch, with constant freezing and hiccups. Now, though, up pops QuickTime, and everything plays beautifully. Interestingly, I've yet to have an issue with Flash on my box running Mint.
That is bizarre.
So this is cool. You heard quite a lot of feedback about this YouTube Perfect script, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, it's really cool. It's really easy to install as well. Mm. Grease Monkey and that YouTube Perfect thing, job done.
I haven't tried it yet.
You really should. Mm. It's, you know, the thing that I used it for this week was to watch Derren Brown do his stupid lottery thing over and over again to see how he did it.
Did you work it out?
I'll give you a clue. It's not in the program that was broadcast how he did it.
And finally, David Winterbottom from commandlinefoo.com,
yay,
which is where we confess to stealing our command line lure from Got In Touch.
I'm the creator of commandlinefoo.com, an avid Ubuntu user and a fan of your excellent podcast. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
I've enjoyed the new command line love section. Feel free to pluck whatever content you like from the site to discuss. I've taken the liberty of adding a banner link through to your site from the bottom of each single command page,
wow,
which is wow. I'm keen to support Linux podcasts. What?
See, Crown does pay.
I'm keen to support Linux podcasts and other open source related resources that will be of interest to the command line foo community. If there are any other worthy podcasts or projects that you think would fit this criteria, let me know and I'll link them in from the site. I've only room for a couple, so we'll have to rotate them.
No, there aren't any others. That is amazing. That's really nice to get that mail. Yeah. And even nicer to have a link on every single command line foo page.
Yeah, I can't help feeling that we don't really deserve it, but it's a lovely thing to have.
Now, I wonder if we stole some content from the BBC, if they'd link to us as well.
Yes, from their legal pages.
He also says,
one thing that you might be able to help me with is licensing. I would like to have the content of the command line foo site licensed so that it's clear that the content is freely available to use and alter, but I'm unsure what the best license would be. Some variant of Creative Commons seems sensible. What would seem the most appropriate to you? Also, can I just retrospectively license all content in one go by slapping a few banners on the site, even though there has been no official license in place before? Could users object if I now distribute their content under a CC license that they didn't agree to when they submitted their stuff? I think the simple answer is yes.
Well, none of us are lawyers.
Yes, with that big proviso, yeah, essentially, if
people didn't, contributed.
Yeah, people contributed and didn't assign copyright over to you or say, do with this what you like, then you shouldn't really just relicense it.
Mm.
You know, the projects that have had to move from GPL2 to GPL v3, like Samba and stuff, have had to make sure that everybody's okay with the license change. Mm-hmm. Wikipedia did when it went from GNU free documentation license to the Creative Commons thing.
PHP did as well.
And Launchpad has as well.
Yeah.
And the Ubuntu project for the Ubuntu documentation wiki as well.
So the good news is it's obviously possible to do the move, but you should ask everybody.
Can't you just release it under the Knock Yourself Out license? Really? I mean, just say Philly Boots. Does it have to be?
Yeah, but the problem is that nobody. The people who contributed, like, what if I put something on command line foo and I put it in there under the proviso that they would be the only people who use it, and then Knock Yourself Out license, which lets anyone use it in any way, shape or form,
mm-hmm,
I'm not happy about. You know, I could protest, and you know, the chances are people won't, they might. But the kind of people who contribute to command line foo are likely to be the kind of people who probably would like open permissive licenses. Yeah. So you might be in luck.
There's also a bit of a gotcha if you do use a Creative Commons license in that it's not compatible with things like the GPL. So you couldn't use a command line foo item in, a GPL bash script or something.
Mm.
So there are little gotchas to get there. Licensing's a horrible subject.
Knock yourself out. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Where,
knock yourself out.
I think on all honesty, for one-liners, public domain. You might as well just go public domain. And let anybody do what
you'll have
like with them.
RMS on your tail for public domain.
I think even he says for short things it's might just worth it.
Maybe
public
we should
domain
get him on the show and ask him.
Yeah, like that's going to happen. We'd have to rename the GNUbuntu UK podcast.
Well, thanks for all your feedback, and we'll have some more next time. Right, it's boiling hot in here. It's time to get out of here. Let's wrap the show up, guys.
Okay,
that was a fun packed show.
It was.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to everyone who took part via Twitter and Identica.
And Facebook.
Oh, yeah. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can email the show via podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
You can leave us a voicemail in a number of ways. Telephone 0845 508 1986 or VoIP podcast@sip.ubuntu-uk.org or Skype us at Ubuntu UK Podcast.
You can send us your comments and get updates from recording sessions on Identica or Twitter, where we are at UUPC.
Join our Facebook fan page, search for Ubuntu, a UK podcast.
We welcome your just a moments, your command line loves, reviews, rants, and feedback, both positive and negative. So please, please, please do get in touch.
And thanks also to our network of community mirrors listed on the website.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.